From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, I speak with writer Paul Hendrickson, author of the memoir Seminary. After spending 7 years studying for the priesthood, Hendrickson left the seminary 6 weeks before he was to take his final vows. Also today, I talk with comedian Meryl Marco. Formerly head writer for Late Night with David Letterman, Marco is now in front of the camera as co-star of a new cable TV comedy special. Musician and folklorist Mick Maloney plays us a couple of tunes he learned in his native Ireland, and critic-at-large Laurie Stone gives her views on this summer's movies. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is Paul Hendrickson. In 1958, at the age of 14, he entered St. Joseph's Preparatory Seminary in Russell County, Alabama, the first step in his chosen path to the priesthood. It was the logical extension of his solidly Catholic upbringing in suburban Illinois, but 7 years later, and just 6 weeks shy of ordination, he left the order. "When I left," Paul Hendrickson writes, "I was 21 years old, a virgin, scared stiff. I had never met a Jew. I had never been on a date. Most of my cultural heroes had saint affixed to their names." He's written a memoir of his experience in the seminary and his re-entry into the secular world. It's titled Seminary, A Search. Paul Hendrickson says he wrote it as an ambivalent believer who has twice married and no longer regularly attends church. Paul Hendrickson is a staff writer for the Style section of the Washington Post. He's been nominated for the Pulitzer Prize 3 times and is currently at work on a biography of Robert McNamara. Seminary, A Search, is published by Summit Books. Welcome to Fresh Air, Paul.
Thank you, Terry.
You entered the seminary at age 14, and that just seems so very young to me to make a decision about how you want to spend your whole life.
Many people have wondered about that, and I myself wonder about it. From the haughty vantage point of 3.5 decades, it seems insane, I know. I must say that back then in the seemingly somnolent 50s, it made a certain sense. The logic, by the way, was derived from the Council of Trent in the 16th century, where you get a person young before he's corrupted by the vice of the world, and he is sort of taken away or takes himself away into this hermetically sealed environment and begins his studies for the priesthood. One of the old seminary buddies that I looked up in the course of the odyssey of writing this book, he said, "You know, Paul, you and I went to high school 400 years ago, and that's sort of it."
Well, your mother very much wanted you to go to the seminary, but did you feel at the age of 14 that you were called?
That word, calling, probably sounds musty now. Even the word vocation has a certain musty ring. I did, but like anything, it's a very complex issue. My mother was a very fervent and is Catholic Irish woman one of whose greatest dreams would be that a son would become a priest. So I was very much influenced by that. We were influenced by the nuns in grammar school. The important thing to know, Terry, is that these boys' seminaries, what I would call the kiddie ministry, this is where the best and brightest Catholic 50s boys went. This was not a liability to go into an institution and begin studying for the priesthood. It was the highest thing you could do. It was the diamond in the cap, the nuns would say.
This was the pre-Vatican II seminary. How did the seminary of the 1950s compare to the seminary today?
I entered the seminary. I got on a train on Michigan Avenue in Chicago and rode southward. And that in itself was something and is part of the story, to go into the lush fields of Alabama. I say in the book that there was nothing in the county where we were except hard shell Baptists and kudzu, which is a Japanese vine that grows everywhere in the South. And why a boys' Catholic seminary was located down there is part of the story. In brief, it's simply that the founder of the order had begun working on black rural missions in the South and decided to locate his seminary in the 1930s down there. But that in itself was an exotic, lush experience. At age 14 or even 13, some of us went. I was only a few months past my 14th birthday to get on this train and to ride 800 or 900 miles into the rural deep South and to begin this experience. It was, which is not really answering your question. I know you asked me about the 50s seminary. It was pre-Vatican II. Vatican II, as some of your listeners might not recall right off, was this worldwide gathering of bishops that began changing the church around drastically in their first convocation in 1962. And the church has never been the same. As you might say, the world has never been the same from the 60s themselves. So I got in sort of in that last calm period before the storm.
You say you were in love with the place in the early time that you were there. Why did you fall in love with it?
Well, there was such a spirit there, maybe a spirit that I have never found elsewhere. And I'm a very happily married man, and I have a son, a baby son I'm crazy about. But the collective spirit of young, highly idealized boys and men all working together in a unit. There were 100-some seminarians and a faculty of 20 or so priests and brothers. It provided a tremendous spirit, emotional spirit. Look, we were with each other constantly. We prayed with each other. We studied with each other. We hiked with each other. We went to the bathroom with each other almost literally because we sat in rows of stalls that were 8 and 10 deep. So, you know, that in itself suggests certain things. That, of course, there were vague, dim sexual innuendos and stirrings. But despite those, there was a collective spirit in that place and maybe a kind of holiness that I have not felt since. And a certain degree of this would be nostalgia talking, but I think that what I feel is deeper and richer and harder at the center than nostalgia.
You were living in an all-male society in the seminary, and I wonder if you had to like prove your masculinity to each other like boys of that age usually expected to do. And in the secular world, that's usually done through showing off about the kinds of dates that you can get. But since sexuality wasn't really a part of it, how was masculinity tested in the seminary?
Often on ball fields, in athletic endeavors. You know, we were constantly busy. We got up every morning at 5:30. 15 minutes later, we were in chapel. We had then meditation for a half hour. We had morning prayers and then meditation and then mass. Then began classes. What I'm leading up to saying is that there were only 50 minutes from 3:10 in the afternoon until 4 o'clock built in for physical recreation. And I'm telling you, after the intensity of all that prayer and study earlier, we ran our fool heads off on that basketball court or touch football that was touch in name only. So there was much of that going on in terms of proving things to one another. In some ways, you could liken it a little to a boys' prep school, but the major difference was that there was always, first and last, this great spiritual overlay that affected everything. We were there. See, we felt that we had a leg up on the world, and maybe the world didn't understand what we were doing or why we were there, but somehow we were going to save souls for Christ. And maybe that sounds pietistic and humanistic and a little ridiculous, but it provided a spirit that was pretty rich.
My guest is Paul Hendrickson, and he's the author of the memoir Seminary. He's also a reporter for the Washington Post. You were in the position of going through puberty away from home at the seminary, a place where sexuality is basically verboten. What kind of advice were you given from the priests who knew that sexual stirrings were starting to happen in your body and in the bodies of the boys in the seminary?
I guess what you would say in the shorthand answer is that there wasn't any given, or there was so little given and it was so furtively given that it didn't help or maybe provided more of a hindrance. Of course, we were emerging in our puberty. We were having our first sexual awakenings, and we were doing it in an all-male environment. And that provided tremendous inward tension, and it was going on in each of us, I'm certain, although I really can only and should only speak for myself. It provided tremendous inward tension that didn't quite have an outlet. You know, unfortunately, I've talked about the richness and the positive experience. There's tremendous negative baggage, emotional baggage that one brings with him into the rest of his life from an experience like this. And I think, unfortunately, that church of the 40s and the 50s and the decades before, the thought was that sexuality is bad. The body is for chastising. The mind is what's important. The mind will get you through. There were tremendous sexual things happening all around us in the school, but none of it was out in the open. And as I say, it made for a kind of fierce, humming, blooded presence, which no one quite was willing to talk about, although you could talk about it in spiritual direction. Spiritual direction, you would pick out one priest on the faculty and you would go to him. But for instance, such a thing as what was then called a nocturnal emission, which is essentially a wet dream, the first time that happened to me, I had not the faintest idea of what was happening with my body. I thought I might be having some sort of epilepsy attack, and I thought I had done something horrible. And I remember talking to my confessor about it the next morning before Mass so that I could go to communion. And he was on the dark side of the screen in the confessional box, and I can't swear to you that I heard a muffled titter, but I do recall that he sort of said, "Relax, son. You simply had a nocturnal emission." It had scared the bejesus out of me to be a little bit sacrilegious suddenly.
So there's probably a lot of guilt bound up in things that you were feeling then.
I think in anything, Terry, that you can't get out and express and simply show that you're human about, it would, as I say, create these inward tensions. But the negative residue from an experience like this, there is a great sense of guilt overlay that I think you take with you through the rest of your life. And I don't mean to sound accusatory. I don't mean to sound bitter. I don't think I'm either of those things. I think I simply am looking a little backwards with my eyes open now in the 1980s, a 43-year-old man trying to move onward and distill this rich, flawed, mysterious, even mystical experience.
You were in the seminary for the changes to Vatican II. What direct change did that create in your life?
I'm by no means, I should say quickly, any sort of authority on church change and the history of the Catholic Church, and I really wrote a personal book trying to describe my experiences. But essentially what happened, Terry, is this. Vatican II radically shook up the Catholic Church, turning the altar around, demystifying the priesthood. And a lot of things happened in that period. Seminaries began to close rapidly. You know, my seminary today is a Job Corps center. I actually have two seminaries because we moved buildings. And it's so painful to go back and see that building, that holy place, as a Job Corps center. I'm speaking of the institution that's in Virginia, the one in Alabama, which was the first one I went to, exists now as a kind of Catholic parish for just a sprinkle of blacks. When the 60s came along, what I try to say in seminary is that the things that were happening in the outer world – the things that eventually happened in the streets of Chicago at the convention at on the campus of Kent State, the war in Vietnam, the assassinations, all of that. Our revolution was one wave behind that, and ours was not as bloodied. It wasn't so bloodied at all, and it wasn't celebrated. It wasn't on the front page of the New York Times, but it was a revolution all the same. And my seminary got affected. All the seminaries around us got affected. You know, I say in the book, just it's not a book of statistics, as you know, but I do say this. When I went to the seminary in 1958, there were 381 major and minor seminaries, Catholic seminaries in the United States. Within 20 years, 259 of those had closed. In my particular seminary, maybe 900 of us went through that place in the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s. One guy from my class is a priest today. The whole school is closed. We all went out. We all went out beyond the walls.
Did you leave because of Vatican II?
It's a complicated answer. Of course we did. The world was changing faster than we could keep up with it. But I had my own internal demons and my own conflicts, and so I was leaving. I was leaving partially because of those, and I was leaving because of all the change in the outside world getting inside the walls. So, of course, Vatican II, but also a papal encyclical called Humanae Vitae, which actually is the birth control cyclical. And for guys who went on and stayed longer than I did and became priests, that encyclical was a terribly disillusioning thing in 1968. It basically reaffirmed that any sort of birth control is a mortal sin.
My guest is Paul Hendrickson, and we're discussing the subject of his memoir, which is called Seminary, and it's about his 7 years in a seminary. We're going to talk some more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Paul Hendrickson is my guest. He's a Washington Post reporter who's also the author of the memoir Seminary, A Search. You went to two seminaries. The first one was in Alabama, and then you moved to one in Virginia. The one in Alabama was older, it was more rustic, it had a lot of old wood around. The one in Virginia, the way you describe it, they went out and they bought a lot of tacky furniture, a lot of formica in this. And I spent a lot of time thinking... And this bothered you a lot. And I've spent a lot of time thinking whether it's a profound or a trivial problem that things were so tacky in the seminary.
I can't decide myself. And I'm sure that I had no awareness back then that formica-topped desks that you couldn't get all four legs ever to stand on the floor at once was any sort of a major problem. That sounds insane. In terms of speaking of all these verities and miracles and mystical sort of things, why would something as ethereal and superficial? But I think subliminally these things were working. They built this brand new building up in the upper south of Virginia. The order had sort of become mainstream church. Down in Alabama, we were rustic, we were poor. There was a sort of radical spirit of poverty. And when we got up to Virginia, the order had suddenly gotten millionaire donors, had sort of come into a mainstream acceptance. It had even commissioned a coat of arms for itself. For some reason, they built this beautiful new plant in Virginia with sturdy brick walls, but then inside, as I said, bought, for want of a better word, tacky furniture. And I remember when I went across the country and found my old mates, which is essentially the motif of this book, as you know, as the fellow said to me, Paul, it was as if we went to high school and college 400 years ago. Another guy said to me, he said, you know, I can suddenly think now, Paul, that When I got out of there, I had the strongest urge to be in a place where I could touch wood again.
Well, the church, especially the Catholic Church, has had a history of awe-inspiring architecture. Beautiful stained glass, fine painting. And, I mean, it does, things that are awe-inspiring like that do, can put you in touch with higher thoughts and, you know, for Micah can make it more of a challenge. But again, you wonder, is this something you should be transcending or something that this should actually
like
be allowed to matter?
It seems like something we should be transcending. I'm reminded suddenly of that Emily Dickinson poem. There's a certain slant of light on winter afternoons that oppresses like the heft of cathedral tunes. And that to me is church, the heft of cathedral tunes on winter afternoons. Something ponderous and heavy, and yet mysterious and holy at the same time.
There was a letter that was sent out from the Holy See Sacred Congregation of seminaries and universities to bishops around the world, and it was about the seminary's role in teaching obedience. This was in 1959 when you were in the seminary. Would you read an excerpt of that letter for us?
Sure. This was... I'm quoting now from this letter of 1959. Let discipline, therefore, joyously embraced, be the touchstone by which superiors test the vocations of their students. Let them demand an obedience, not merely theoretical, but effective, single-minded, and complete in all things, great and small, contained in the seminary rule. Let them always remember that obedience primarily involves obsequium, that is, a total submission of mind and heart which makes our actions pleasing to God. If superiors can achieve this much, they can be assured that their students will also acquire the other virtues proper to a priest, especially those like chastity, which require manly willpower and perfect self-control.
I think that that letter really sums up one of the really big dilemmas for anyone in religion, which is the question of obedience and authority. Obedience to authority can be a discipline to basically get out of your own ego, to get out of the self. But you can also just end up... you can also end up just being part of the bureaucracy and following people who aren't making good decisions about your life.
Of course, it seems to take away free will. It seems to take away individual choice. It seems to take away conscience. Does it take away conscience? I'm editing myself. But it seems to implant fear where choice and intellect should also have a huge place. I'm not sure they meant it that way, in the way, in a sense, we're talking about it. These were not malevolent people. These were people who had learned from their predecessors and were doing the best they could and were trying to make us into individuals who could go out and spread the faith. You know, the motto of my order was ad fidem servandam, for going out and preserving the faith and getting souls for Christ. And again, that from this complex, value-free world we live in, I put those things in quotes, that sounds a little something to snicker at. But you know, in some ways, we threw out the baby with the bathwater. Those old values... there are lasting good and deep things about them. My mother is a fervent churchgoer and has not quite understood all of the changes of the modern world, and I think she's better for it sometimes not understanding.
You left the seminary about 6 weeks before it was time to take your vows, and that must have been maybe the most difficult decision you've ever had to make in your life. Why did you leave then? You'd spent so many years building to this, and then you bailed out at the last minute.
Even now, that haunts me. It wasn't working. I was about to say suddenly wasn't working. It hadn't been working for a year. I was in the period of novitiate, which is even a more rigorous training than the regular seminary. I was preparing to take vows, which would have been binding for 3 years, vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. At the end of that period, I would have taken them again, which would have been for life. In any case, to be dispensed from those vows, you would have had to go to Rome and go through long, difficult channels. So my name was Brother Garrett. I wore a religious habit. I was preparing to step forward and take these vows, and I left. It was an anguished decision, but somehow or other I had seemed to outgrow that life. It wasn't viable any longer. I had gone in there shortly after age 13, and now I was 21, and the world was changing, and I was changing. It was like a kid shooting out of his shoes. There was a growth imbalance. There was too much change, and I didn't feel I had a vocation any longer. And I, you know, I use that old word a little bit ruefully and ironically.
It's interesting now you're writing for the Washington Post style section, and I'm sure you're writing a lot about popular culture, some of which you missed out on while you were in the seminary. Has it been hard to catch up on those years that you were cloistered?
I'm 43. I have a 3.5-year-old son, the only child. My life, you might say, has been a process of catch up, which is not all bad, I've come to understand. When I came out in the swamp hot summer of 1965, age 21, I didn't know who the Rolling Stones were. You know, I vaguely knew about the Gulf of Tonkin. It was somewhere over where a war was going on. I couldn't have begun to have told you where Vietnam was. I really was emerging from a kind of womb with, by the way, a buzz haircut, and I weighed 135 pounds. My wife now, who looks at those old pictures of me, she saw a picture that was taken 6 weeks after I left, and she said I looked like an escapee from Dachau.
You are, I'm sure, still wrestling with all of the religious questions that you wrestled with while in the seminary, but now you're living in the secular world and you don't even attend church regularly. Have you made your search a more secular search now?
Yeah. The last word in this book is search. I think the sentence is, for now, though, I keep searching. And incidentally, last Sunday I went to church. It was the first time in what? 2 or 3 years that I attended a Catholic service. I can't exactly tell you why. My old mates, whom I went and found in the course of writing this book, they say they slip into churches now and then at noon hours, and they don't particularly think of themselves as tragic. The old formulas and the old structures don't work anymore exactly, and yet there's the longing. There's the longing and the need somehow to be in touch with what? With the wood and not the formica.
But you're still searching.
I think I'll always be searching. I hope that that's what I'm about. I hope that's what being alive is about.
Paul Hendrickson, I want to thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you.
My guest has been Paul Hendrickson, and he's the author of a memoir titled Seminary, A Search, that's about the 7 years he spent in a seminary. It's published in paperback by Summit Books. He's also a writer for the Washington Post style section. My name's Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next program, I'll speak with James Miller. His book, Democracy in the Streets, examines the student protest movements of the 1960s, so I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, comedy writer Meryl Marco talks about her stint as head writer for David Letterman and her new role co-starring with Harry Shearer on a cable TV comedy special. Irish balladeer and folklorist Mick Maloney plays a couple of tunes from the old country, and critic-at-large Laurie Stone gives her guide to this summer's movies. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. Today we've invited musician and folklorist Mick Maloney to join us for our weekly performance session. He's going to play a few songs that he learned in his native Ireland.
I live in Philadelphia now, but I grew up in the southwest of Ireland, County Limerick, and spent a lot of time in the counties of Kerry and Clare, where there were a lot of old singers and musicians. This is one of the earliest songs I learned there. Sullivan's John, to the road you've gone, far away from your native home. You've gone with the tinker's daughter far beyond the road to Rome. Sullivan's John, you won't stick it long till your belly will soon get slack. You'll be roaming the road with the mighty Lord and your toodle-box on your back. I met Katie Coffey, she didn't need baby, 'twas behind on her back strapped on. She'd an owlash plant in her hand for to drive the donkey on. Enquiring at every alehouse as along the road she'd pass, saying, where would I get an old pot to mend? Or where would I swap an ass? Well, there's a hairy ass fair in the County Clare, in a place they call Spancel Hill, where my brother James got a rap of a hames, and poor Paddy they tried to kill. They loaded him up on an ass and car, while Kate and Big Mary looked on. A bad cess to the day that I went away to join the tinker clan. Sullivan's John, to the road you've gone, far away from your native home. You've gone with the tinker's daughter far beyond the roads to Rome. Oh, Sullivan's John, you won't be long till your belly will soon get it's like Newby Roman Road, with a mighty load on your toolbox, on your back. Well, that was a song that I associate with the singing of a man called the Pecker Dunn, who was a travelling man. It used to be called Tinkers in Ireland, but it's not a term that the travellers like to hear. And a lot of the songs and stories that I ended up hearing, and a lot of the tunes as well, were carried from one part of Ireland to the other by the travellers. At the time when I grew up, Ireland was just starting to, well, enter into the modern world of middle class values and incomes and styles of living, and this old music and singing didn't seem to have much part in that. And I remember when I was growing up that the older musicians, particularly around County Clare, would always love to see somebody who was of the younger generation coming along, and they'd never tell you weren't playing it right or anything. They'd encourage you all the way. It was just non-stop encouragement, telling you that you know, to keep with it and don't let it up and so on. And all the music I play, I owe to those older musicians. I'd like to play a couple of tunes now that I learned in County Clare many years ago. The first is called The Sailor on the Rock, and the second is called Tear the Calico, and I don't know where I remember them from or learned them from. You just sort of pick them up. I'm going to play them on the mandolin, which is one of the instruments I started off with. The Sailor on the Rock and Tear the Calico, and in an evening of Irish entertainment, singing and music and dancing, tunes like that could go on for 6 or 7 hours. We didn't go on that long this time.
Mick Maloney is director of the International Village Fair, a 9-day cultural festival taking place in Philadelphia July 25th to August 2nd. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Meryl Marco. She's been a TV writer and producer for the last 10 years. She's worked on many pilots that never made it to air, and she's written for sitcoms like Buffalo Bill and Newhart. One pilot became The Late Night with David Letterman show. She was the head writer for Letterman's morning talk show, and when the late night program began in 1982, she was its first head writer. After writing for a year, she became a segment producer. Her specialty was animals. She left the show last year to produce, write, and perform on her own. And she has. Marco and comedian Harry Shearer have created an upcoming comedy special for cable called This Week Indoors. They hope the show becomes a series. In the program, Marco plays herself as the on-camera roving reporter who observes and comments on some of the quirkier sides of contemporary life. I asked Meryl Marco if she always knew she would work in comedy.
I plain old can't relate to anything without using humor, so it just became a real relief when I found a category of things where it was an asset.
I think in order to make it as a humorist or a writer, you really have to have a certain amount of faith in yourself. Were you convinced?
I've never found that to be true.
Were you convinced?
In fact, everyone I know in humor has no faith in themselves whatsoever. I think that's the core of it.
Well, were you convinced that you could be funny enough to actually make it?
No, I just think that your overwhelming instinct as a funny mouth just get you in trouble, and just it just is your personality. You know, it's the sort of thing that just seems to be the most natural thing to do.
When you first started writing for TV, do you think it was any harder for you to get a foothold because you were a woman? I think most of television writing is still dominated by men, and certainly was in the late 70s when you started writing for television.
Oddly enough, I've never run into that. I made a career switch from, I used to teach art briefly. I taught painting at USC for a year. And it was much, much, much harder to get a job teaching painting at USC than it ever was for me to get into television. I don't know what that means. Well, I just sort of was able to get, I had this idea that I wanted to try writing for television, and I was reinforced so quickly when I actually gave it a try that all seemed to be a sign that I might as well keep at it because it was fun and I was being reinforced.
You were the head writer on the David Letterman show, both the daytime show and then the late night show. You know what I've always tried to figure out? If you're the head writer and you think that your writers aren't being quite funny enough, what can you possibly do to get them to be funnier? I mean, I don't know.
Well, you really can't do anything. I learned that. That's why you got to get great people. And we really, from the time that Late Night started, we got just tremendously smart writers on that show. And they were really carefully selected for sharing a very specific sense of humor with me and with Dave. And they never let us down. I mean, we had just some really funny guys writing on that show.
Gee, was it ever behind the scenes like the old Dick Van Dyke show where Dick Van Dyke and Rosemarie and Maury Amsterdam used to sit around trying to write material?
Yeah, that's sort of what it is like. Yeah, it's just a continuum of generating ideas. But for people who like that sort of thing, like me and like the people I've worked with, it's about the neatest job you can possibly have is to generate funny ideas. I mean, I do it even without a show. And it's greater to do it for a show and know it's going to go on the air somewhere.
When you started the Late Night with David Letterman show, did you want to do a kind of almost parody version of the Johnny Carson show? I remember at that time David Letterman was considered one of the heirs to the Tonight Show, and he might have replaced Johnny Carson. That never happened.
Yeah. Well, what our intention was to Dave and I were both, each of us, and jointly looking for just a real flat out fun creative outlet, and we knew we wanted to be nothing like the Johnny Carson show. We weren't doing a parody of the Johnny Carson show so much as we were interested, if we were going to follow the Johnny Carson show, in being something else so there'd be a reason to watch it, because the Johnny Carson show is what it is, and what's the point of having two of them in a row? Plus, actually, frankly, like that, the sensibility of the Tonight Show is not my sensibility at all. You know, I rarely see anything on the Tonight Show that reminds me of anything I would have come up with.
How did you get the kind of opening monologue that Letterman does created? It's very different from the kind of jokes that Carson tells at the beginning.
Well, that's just Dave's sense of humor versus Johnny's sense of humor. That we were originally asked not to do a monologue. What Dave is now doing is just sort of evolved out of what he used to call opening remarks. He wanted to come out and make contact with the audience before starting the show. And he picks his jokes based on what he thinks is funny, and he picks his joke writers based on writers he thinks are funny, and that's the combination of those two things is what you see him doing at the front of the show.
You originated Stupid Pet Tricks. How'd you come up with the idea?
Well, I'm just sort of a dog obsessive, and it struck me, we were looking for ideas for the show, and it just struck me that everybody I knew who had pets had some stupid thing that they'd make you watch their pets do when you brought them over. The particular idea that I remember thinking of when I thought of the idea was some friends of mine who live in Northern California. Whenever we would go over to their house, they would put socks on their dog. And this would be a big form of entertainment. That was sort of, so I thought, well, everyone does this.
You left the head writer position on the Letterman show to be a segment producer. Why did you want to make that change?
Well, I was only the head writer the first year, and it just had to do with, it was just completely personal. It was too much pressure for me to be responsible for every single thing that Dave was doing and saying on the air. It was just imagine it, if you will. You know, I was living with the man, and it was waking up in the middle of the night, and if things didn't go well, I was taking it really personally. And sometimes, you know, I mean, maybe you don't want to go home with the person that you possibly didn't do the best job for that day or whatever. You know, I mean, it was just too, it was too much. It was just, I couldn't do it anymore.
You're completing an HBO pilot, which is soon to be broadcast. Would you describe the concept for us of the pilot?
The concept was myself and the exciting Mr. Harry Shearer both wanted a creative outlet. When we were brought together to work together, we both of us, since I've left late night, I really miss the creative outlet. I have a lot of 3-minute ideas that I like to do. I have like millions of short ideas, and I still want that outlet. I just no longer have it at late night, and that's what the concept of This Week endorses. It's a chance for Harry and I both to do anything we want.
Well, I've seen a preview of the pilot, which I enjoyed very much, and there's a segment in it that I really found especially funny, in which I hope I'm not giving away too much, but you go to get a makeover, and you get a makeover by two men who are transvestites and make up themselves and other men. And how did you find out about these guys, and what led you to go get a makeover from them?
Well, I've always been extremely cynical on the topic of beauty and makeovers anyway. And it once dawned on me when I was watching some female impersonators that I think there's exactly the same amount of distance between me and Dolly Parton as there is between any guy and Dolly Parton. And I was thinking, well, why is this? This is so odd. And so I thought that was the original idea. And then I also always look at these beauty and health programs and books and so forth with such a jaundiced eye, because you just realize, you know, in order to prepare for this thing, I read through Christie Brinkley's book and Jacqueline Smith and so forth. And all of their makeover tips, which all women, I think, spend your lives reading and trying to absorb and thinking, geez, if only I could just pick up a few tips, I could be Christie Brinkley. And for me anymore, I just realize it's the difference between a Cocker Spaniel and a Greyhound. You know, it's Christie Brinkley says, wake up in the morning and splash a little water on your face. And you go, yeah, uh-huh. Yeah, I think that'll do it. That'll make me look like Christie Brinkley. I find all that stuff just enraging. And it's also, I feel bad for women, myself included, that we all care about that so much.
I actually found it pretty funny that the guys who were making you up were much more comfortable with makeup than you were.
Yeah, well, that was the idea behind the thing. I was thinking when I was watching the female impersonation show, I was thinking, how is it that this guy knows more about this than I do? And he's walking across the stage in high heels and a lamé gown, and he's not falling, and he's not tripping, and he's not breaking a heel. How come I don't know how to do that?
You spent a lot of your career behind the scenes, writing for other people who were actually on camera. In your HBO special, you are on camera as well as behind the scenes writing. Did you enjoy performing for it?
I'm very worried. I'm really nervous about it. I'm very, very nervous about it. I love it. I love it a lot. I've been for the last year and a half doing local segments for local news in Los Angeles, and it was an extension of what I was doing producing the remotes for late night. I was doing everything on those except for eventually having to give away the fun part to Dave. And when I started doing the whole thing myself, it was just the greatest gift. I thought, my God, why didn't I get to do this sooner? I loved it. I love everything about it.
Okay. Well, Meryl, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Meryl Marco's special, This Week Indoors, is an upcoming HBO Cinemax comedy experiment. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
Well, Oliver North is ending his first week as a media star.
He sure is. And we'll be hearing in our report this evening about what one member of the committee described as a CIA within a CIA, the great array of covert activities that seem to be organized by the National Security Council staff. We'll also hear the complaint of Scott Armstrong, who runs the National Security Archives, it's an independent group, that the investigation is too narrowly focused. Former Watergate committee investigator Armstrong says that this would be like investigating just one burglary. On the other hand, he'll be talking with Senator George Mitchell of Maine, who says the committee investigation is right on target.
Thank you, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Like many of us, our critic at large, Laurie Stone, has been spending a lot of time at the movies this summer. She's been disgruntled by most, but she's also found a few surefire pleasures.
Everybody wants to be Siskel and Ebert. Everyone is Siskel and Ebert. Here's my go at summer movies. The majority I've seen made me cranky. Today's bad movies aren't worse than yesterday's bad movies, but they're bad in particular ways. Postmodernism has hit the suburbs of entertainment. Too many movie makers have ambition but nothing to say. Their work is often technically skilled, but references to movies of the past are flashed without meaning or feeling. It's the tactic of most rock videos. The first floor of Bloomingdale's got up as the human condition. Two chilling models of the ersatz form are Alan Parker's Angel Heart, released earlier this year, and its replicant offspring, Wayne Wang's Slam Dance. The sets are expensive, the actors trendy, and the photography hallucinatory. The trouble is, no one bothered with dialogue, characters, or a story. The same is true of The Squeeze, starring Michael Keaton. This movie is a concept that never got out of its petri dish, and the numbing Ali Sheedy vehicle, Made to Order, about a spoiled L.A. heiress who has to work as a maid, never developed beyond its title. Speaking of Loxes, Dragnet and Spaceballs would lay there inert and glassy-eyed, even if they were cut to 10-minute Saturday Night Live skits. George Miller's Witches of Eastwick and Stanley Kubrick's Full Metal Jacket are too craftily constructed to be boring. They don't work because they're heartless. Witches outdirts John Updike's mean satire of feminism by utterly suffocating its women characters and stars with patronization. Stanley Kubrick is one of the great visual artists working in movies, but his film is willed. He has nothing felt to say about Vietnam, just a need to play the great man making his statement about a crucial piece of American history. Kubrick shows you don't have to have base motives to be shallow. I also saw three movies which prove you don't have to have arty motives to stimulate and entertain. You have to have a commitment to a genre. You have to have a vision of how people and society work, and you have to have something to say about them. For the splatter flick crew, I recommend Paul Verhoeven's RoboCop. The ultraviolence is seriously ultra, but the movie has a witty worker's view of society, where cop killers look like intellectuals and serve the interests of WASP-run corporations. RoboCop, who is part machine and part man, is the ultimate working sap, programmed to carry out orders and purged of memory. But in the movie's most interesting subplot, this modern Frankenstein finds his humanity. The small-budget British film Withnail and I is about two young men and the erotic power of class attraction. Here, dialogue brilliantly etches character, and it is character which the filmmaker Bruce Robinson cares about. Amid this summer's movie crop, that alone is extraordinary. But my favorite movie so far is Joe Dante's Inner Space. It comes out of the Spielberg factory and has traits of his formula, but it transcends them again and again. The inspired Martin Short is a hypochondriac injected with a miniaturized test pilot played by Dennis Quaid. Short is a schlep, but not a sexual neuter, and part of the film's fun is watching him become infected with his invader's courage. Witty conceits keep popping in the dialogue, from Alice in Wonderland to The Exorcist. The plot not only moves, but has a loony logic, and some of the bits are hilarious and touching at the same time. You have to see Short and Quaid getting drunk and dancing, one inside the other, to Sam Cooke's Twist in the Night Away. That's what I call intimacy, and this movie got under my skin.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic, and is a contributor to The Village Voice. Here's a preview of our next program. On our next show, I'll speak with humorist Alice Kahn. Her credits include coining the term yuppie. Also, jazz critic Francis Davis will review Digital Duke, the new recording of Ellington Classics. And television critic David Bianculli will review coverage of the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North. So I hope you can join us. And we'd like to hear from you. Write to us with your comments and suggestions. Our address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Today's program was produced by Fred Landerl, with producers Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Additional assistance today from Lisa Bruton. Our engineers are Richard Parker and Ron Barron. Chris Burgeon directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.